This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Greetings, and welcome to Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher, also known as the Food Healer, and I'm really excited about today's show. We are speaking to author Susan Ewing all about her book, Resurrecting the Shark. So, Susan, are you there?
I'm here. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I found your book in the bookstore, and I was blown away by the whole thing. So I'm really, really excited to share this information with my listeners and have them go out and buy your book because it was super, super cool and I'd love to hear that.
Thank you.
So first question is, what encouraged you to write Resurrecting the Shark?
Well, okay, so this is a book about a very mysterious fossil shark. And I didn't really know anything about it, but a friend of mine is an artist, and he's been obsessed by this animal for 20 years. And I like I say, I hadn't really thought that much about it, but there were some scientific breakthroughs just in 2013, and the people involved created this traveling museum exhibit. So I drove down to Pocatello, Idaho. I live in Montana, so I drove down to Pocatello, Idaho, for the opening of the exhibit, and I was blown away by the fossils. I'd never seen the actual fossils, and they're beautiful physical objects. And then I started meeting some of the scientists that had pushed through this new scientific discoveries, and they were very sort of unlikely people, you know, an undergraduate combat veteran from Iraq and covered with tattoos and an artist and an invertebrate guy. And so I started learning more about the human story, too, and more about the animal. And it just seemed like such an incredible story that I just thought, oh, my gosh, I just have to see if I can figure out how to tell this story.
Well, you know, it's funny because when I was first looking through, I was walking through Barnes & Noble and I found your book. And I mean, I cracked up because, like, I looked, you know, I picked it up, I looked at the cover. I have a background in graphic design, so I'm always all about the cover. And I'm looking at these drawings of this shark, and I hate to even admit this, it took me, like, a couple minutes to realize what was going on with this. And so the shark, please tell me if I'm saying this wrong, Helicoprion, is that right?
Depends on what part of the world you're from. I think most people say Helicoprion.
Ooh, that's fancy. Okay, so the Helicoprion, I mean, this thing looks like it comes from out of a Tim Burton movie. It's truly a sea monster in, like, the greatest ways. Could you describe it for our listeners?
Yeah, and again, this beast has been extinct for a long, long time. And one of the things that makes it so unusual is its tooth structure. So imagine it was as bigger than the biggest great white shark. So they got up to 20 to 30 feet long. So they're huge animals.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it's speculative, really, what the whole body looked like, although, you know, there's best guesses from other fossil evidence. But anyway, so there are these big, gigantic sharks, except for you can picture, like, a great white shark and all the sharks that we know, the toothed sharks. They had a bunch of teeth in their jaws, of course. So this guy, the Helicoprion, had a kind of a narrow, pointed lower jaw and sort of stuck in the very middle of that lower jaw like a pizza cutter stuck in a quart of ice cream is this spiral of teeth. And so it looked like a circular saw of teeth with just half of it showing, and it didn't spin, and I can try to explain how it worked and stuff. But so that was the most unusual thing about the shark is the teeth did not grow on its jaws like a normal shark, but it was a circular structure embedded in the center of its lower
Oh, it's wild. Yeah. I mean, it really looks like something that was just drawn for a fantasy novel, you know, and that's really what was like, that's what blew me away when I saw this, because it really, you know, it was like, is this real? It was so unusual to what we're used to today, you know?
Yeah, and that's why it took scientists so long to figure out how the world, where the world fit on the shark. For like 100 years, it was this big game of pin the world on the shark, because all they had for fossil evidence was this tooth whorl. And most of the tooth whorls are about the size of a dinner plate, so, you know, 10 to 12 inches, although they do get bigger. And so it was all they had to go on. And the scientific breakthrough in 2013, they CT scanned one of the fossils, like, you know, just like medical CT scans, only heavier duty, and they were able to find some fossilized jaw material inside the rock. And so for the first time in over 100 years, this group of quirky collaborators were able to figure out how that whorl fit in the jaw. And over time, I mean, some scientists, it took them a long decades to believe that this thing actually fit inside the shark's mouth. They pictured it growing over the top of the snout and growing up over the back. They thought it might be fin spines and in the tail. And they just had a really hard time trying to imagine it in the mouth. And so this work in 2013 is what really finally put it inside the mouth.
And it makes total sense. I mean, it's like, you know, for any of you guys at home, Google this animal and you'll see exactly what we're talking about, because it really is. It's like, how does this work? Is this, you know, teeny, teeny, tiny comparatively? But like, you know, I've seen some images of the fossils, and the fossils are big. It's not like something that would fit in the palm of your hand. It looks like it's something like almost like, you know, a slice of a bowling ball, like that kind of size.
Yep, like that size or the size of a dinner plate. The biggest one is about 2.5 feet in diameter, so you can imagine it's a really big animal that those things fit in.
That is wild. And so when were these guys around, and how long did they, like, where did they live? Were they everywhere?
They were. And in the book, so they were alive during the middle of the Permian period, and that was, so they were living about 270 million years ago, 270 to 260 million years ago or so. So in the middle of the Permian, and that's when you guys might have heard of the supercontinent of Pangaea. So the Earth, that's what the Earth was the configuration of the Earth at that time was Pangaea, and Pangaea is kind of shaped like a sea, and it was just one big supercontinent. And so they have found fossils all over the world, and when they plot the location of today's fossil on a map of Pangaea, you can see that the sharks circled almost the entire, there was a seaway that they cut through, but they call it pan global. So they were all over the globe at that time, and they existed for about 10 million years, which is a really good run for a large apex predator. They had a really good run.
Wow. And it's so amazing to think of, you know, that something lived for 10 million years before we were even, like, a thought, you know, and that there's still proof of this on the planet. This is amazing to me.
I know. That's the cool thing I think about paleontology and the fossil record is, you know, you think of the number of species alive today, and it's just a bare blink of a fraction of all the animals that have ever existed on the planet. You know, animals have arisen and gone extinct since life began. Complex life began about in the Cambrian, like about 600 million years ago or so. And so ever since that time, species, genuses, genera, families, you know, they've been coming and going. And it's mind-boggling to think how many animals have been alive on this planet that are no longer here today. And then the fossil record is just a tiny snapshot of all those animals. We really don't have a clue, you know, how many animals and what was here except for what we can find in the fossil record, which is really, really sketchy.
And, I mean, it's like, you know, what blows my mind, too, is that, you know, paleontologists will find this fossil of, like, a fraction of something, and then are able to build from that. And that blows my mind. It reminds me of like the it's like forensics, you know, where they'll like have a fraction of a skull and they can completely make what this person looked like just through the math and through the details of taking that one piece and knowing the proportions and things like that. So it's like with paleontology, it's just got to be wild because it's like, you know, is this a tooth? Is this a nail? What is this? And what did this belong to? And, you know, like all the answers that they can get from a small impression in a stone is fascinating to me.
It is. It is. And it's I think they call it a historical science because it's all about context and relationships. And it's total sleuthing and total detective work. And it used to be in the, you know, paleontology arose in the, like in the, it was kind of in its beginnings in the 1800s and back then. And they didn't have the same technology that we do today. And so they used something which scientists still use today, which I think is really interesting, which is called comparative anatomy. And so, you know, all the vertebrate animals basically all have sort of the same bones. They're different shapes and, you know, different places in the body and stuff. But so they just, the paleontologists need to find sort of something that looks similar and then go from there. And then you can tell a lot from the time period because they're learning more about the environments in geologic time. And today they're doing with technology, with CT scans and all the genomic things that scientists are doing. It's a really sophisticated field of study these days. You know, it's different than just trying to reconstruct animals based on the fossilized bones you found. There's chemistry studies and all kinds of stuff. It is, and you know, putting together what the environments were like through pollen studies. And so you put all these pieces together until you finally have a picture. But even then, you know, you can't be totally sure because it was a long time ago and nobody got it.
It's tough to find notes from back then, you know?
Yes, it is.
Wow. And so, I mean, where were these fossils discovered? Where was this found?
Well, the first helicoprine fossil ever discovered was found in Western Australia in the late 1880s. And we just know his name was Mr. Davis, and we know his name because his name sort of traveled along with the fossil. The fossil passed from hand to hand to hand, but, you know, everyone said, well, Mr. Davis found this when they passed it along to the next person. And it was just a fragment of the spiral, and it had about 14 tooth crowns on it. And he was just out looking for gold, probably, in Western Australia at that time. There was a sort of a gold thing going on. And so he gave it to, actually, a clergyman in Perth who managed to get it to England, to the prominent paleontologists of the time. But they didn't know what it was because nobody had ever seen anything like that. So they guessed what it was, and they lumped it in with an existing genus of prehistoric shark. But then in the 1890s, in the late 1890s, a full spiral was found in the Ural Mountains of Russia. So the first fossil was a fragment found in Western Australia. The next fossil was a beautiful, beautiful specimen that was found in the Ural Mountains. And that fossil ended up on the desk of Alexander Karpinsky, who loved puzzling fossils. He loved to get fossils that nobody else knew what they were, and this is a good example. And he didn't find them himself. That's one of the things I love about this story is it's so full of coincidence and chance and people picking things up and going, oh, this is interesting. I wonder if this is something. And so they just keep passing it along until someone goes, yes, I know something about that, or I want to learn something about that. And so Karpinsky, in 1899, was the one who named the genus of Helicoprion. Helicoprion is a genus, and so he named it, and he named it for the Greek helico, meaning spiral, and prion, meaning saw, so spiral saw. So he's the one that really got things going, and he pictured the world growing up over the animal's snout like a big party favor over its snout or something, and turned out to be wrong, and that raised a sometimes very snarky debate among international scientists. Everybody's going, that can't be right. That looks ridiculous. But then what the other guys did, what the other scientists said, that was equally ridiculous. And so they just kept on with that for a long time until World War One and the Russian Revolution interfered with the science of the time, and the debate kind of faded away until sort of the next interesting fossils were found, and people started looking at it again.
Unreal. I mean, it's so funny. This is something, history and wars, it wouldn't even cross my mind that would have anything to do with paleontology.
I know. That was one of the really interesting things for me, too. I'm a natural history writer. I'm not a paleontologist, and so I had to learn a lot about these things myself. And all the way through this story, the cultural history and the social history really affected how things progressed in terms of the science. Even some of the early paleontologists before this particular story, but that were working on related species that the affects the story. Well, the Civil War started, and so the scientists who were working on the earth sciences during the Civil War, they went to work as surgeons, mostly in the Union Army, and working on different military things. And it happened again in World War One. It happened again with World War Two. It was very interesting to me, sort of the intersection of history and science. Just sort of as a side note about how the flow of human culture affects the flow of science.
Totally. Totally. Well, Susan, we have to take a minute and a half for station identification. So for everybody else, we are speaking with Susan Ewing all about Resurrecting the Shark, her book. We'll be back in about a minute and a half, so just stay tuned.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
And we are back. I am talking to Susan Ewing all about her incredibly fascinating book, Resurrecting the Shark, about an ancient shark genus. So, yep. Susan, do you have any idea why this shark went extinct?
Probably a gradual shift in the prey base. So some of your listeners might be aware of the Great Permian extinction. At the end of the Permian, I think, I can't remember the number off the top of my head, something like 90% of species went extinct. It was a major, major extinction event. There have been about five big extinction events on the Earth. And so, but the extinction of Helicoprion appears not to have had anything to do with that, because Helicoprion went extinct about 10 million years before the Permian boundary. But they're not exactly clear on the details of that big extinction, and it may have taken place over a long period of time. So you can imagine Helicoprion was so specialized, and this is one of the interesting things about evolution and extinction and all that stuff, is that you might have heard the adage adapt, migrate, or die. So all species on the earth, humans, all of us, you know, it's you have to either adapt, you migrate, or you die. And Helicoprion was so highly specialized. I mean, that tooth whorl really painted it into a corner in terms of what it could eat and how it could survive. And so potentially a little hiccup in its prey base could have been enough to set it on sort of its death spiral. But nobody knows exactly for sure.
And so one of the things that you talk about is background extinction and accelerated extinction. Can you tell us what the difference is between those two things?
Yeah, for you know, most of the planet's life, extinction is a really natural process. It's part of evolution. Species, you know, species evolve and species die, and it's just a natural part of the natural order. But then since this is arguable, and this is you know, some people might say that this is opinion, but since human beings have come onto the scene, there seems to be an accelerated rate of extinctions that are radically higher than the quote-unquote background extinction rate. And you think of the dodo, and you think of you know, all the species that the passenger pigeon, mammoths, even things like that seem to have gone extinct from human-based causes. And so,
yay, people!
And so that's Elizabeth Colbert wrote an excellent book on that, The Sixth Extinction, and she goes into a lot of detail. It's a really excellent book. I would highly recommend it. And And that was one of the interesting things to me, learning more about Helicoprion, is it's really important for, I think, informed citizens today to be able to separate things like natural extinctions and accelerated extinctions, because we need to know what the difference is. Extinction in itself is not a bad thing. It's a natural thing. But if we as humans push extinctions, we need to think about that and think about, you know, is that okay? And what are the consequences of that? So it's just there's so many interesting things to think about in terms of evolution and extinction and you know, the planet and Earth processes. It's really, really interesting and really cool.
I mean, the thing for me, it's funny because, you know, I've been doing this show for a while now, and so what many times when we're discussing, like, a certain animal, it's like, you know, what is their job? Because what I'm finding is that every animal that's on this planet has a certain role or a certain job that they have that, you know, is specifically for them for the most part, and so we need them there for the balance of it. So to have this belief, which is the truth, that, you know, extinction is natural and this is what happens because we've been seeing it for millions and millions and millions of years. But it's also like, you know, then what is the balance? Like, what has to come to take the place of whatever it is that became extinct?
Right.
And it amazes me that nature is able to figure this out and, you know, solve it themselves, basically.
Right, and you could look at it like we all change jobs over our lifetime, right? It's a little bit of a lame comparison, but, you know,
I kind
of
love it.
we adapt and change. And what drives, I think what drives extinctions and evolution and what drives life on this planet is Earth processes and climatic forces. And that's like plate tectonics. You guys, you probably are aware of that. You know, the Earth is continually shifting, and during the Permian, the Earth, map of the Earth, you saw this one giant continent, the supercontinent of Pangaea, and that was only one configuration of many that the Earth has had over geologic time. And when the Earth shifts its plate positions, then the climate changes, and when the climate changes, the environment changes. You know, there's deserts that come up. You know, Pangaea had a big desert in the middle of the supercontinent, and then when sea levels rise and fall based on the Earth shifting and moving around. So sea levels rise and fall, and that changes sometimes the temperature of the oceans, which changes the balance of life in the oceans. And so really, it's the physical forces of the Earth that are playing all we living organisms. That's really what affects things. You know, is what can live in what habitat, and what dictates what habitat there is mm-hmm. is how the Earth is set up and what the environment is like.
Well, okay, so then it's also like, I mean, I don't know if anything has, if there is anything, with the exception of like an insect, that could really show extreme evolution in basically like a human lifetime. Maybe the finches that Darwin studied in the Galapagos or something like that. But so it's like, I mean, is it kind of like, you know, somebody's walking through the Amazon jungle and all of a sudden they see something they've never seen before and been like, oh my God, what is that? And it's a brand new species? Or is this something that is just so gradual that, you know, as humans, we're just never going to see this kind of thing?
I don't know the answer to that because I'm not a scientist. And I think mm-hmm. I think that's a topic of animated conversation among scientists. And you read Stephen Jay Gould, who I think he was the one who had the idea of these sort of periodic leaps of evolution. I could have that wrong, so I shouldn't even be talking about this stuff too much. But I don't know. It's a mystery to me. But you know, you think about it, scientists. We as a species, we've been observing species on this planet for, I don't know, maybe 10,000 years or something like
yeah.
that, you know. And so what we've seen and observed is a pretty small snapshot of time.
Totally. And, like, have been conscious of it and have taken, you know, at that time have been able to take notes as well. And it's not just, yeah. you know, like folklore, you know, tales that have come down generation upon generation.
Yeah.
I mean, this stuff is just, I'm so fascinated by this, and I'm so fascinated that this fossil has, you know, unleashed this entire conversation and really made people, like, for me, it's, you know, for me, extinction is always a really scary word because I'm not a scientist and because I'm, you know, I'm pretty much looking at here and the now. So, you know, when we're, like, we've done an episode on the rhinos who are going extinct at high speed, you know, and that there's yeah. one white or black rhino left, which breaks my heart. It's like the saddest story ever. But yeah. to hear that, you know, this is, you know, with the exception of human interaction, like, this is what happens. Like, we are in a constant state of flux. It kind of is a little reassuring. It's kind of like, it's not all bad, guys. This is what it's supposed to be. Like, it's, for some, it's funny because I wasn't expecting this to happen, but for me, it's kind of giving me a little feeling of security. Like, it's cool, you know? Yeah. I mean, granted, with global warming and speeding up as it is, it's not fantastic, but to know that change is part of life, I think, is a really important thing to keep in mind.
It is. And then I think it helps us make more informed choices too, and better choices is, you know, if we know the science behind extinction, then we can make choices about if we want to try to not have this great impact on species, we can mm-hmm. we can make better choices.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's super important too.
Yeah, yeah. So knowledge, you know, knowledge is really important, and perspective. And the more we know about how, I think, the more we know about how the planet really works, the better care we can take of it.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
So how do you think that this shark, how do you think it got such a funky bunch of people that were really standing behind it? Like, you're saying that your team is not the team is not like your traditional team of like all science, that there's an artist, and like, how do you think this happened?
I think that's one of the things that drew me to this story, is that everybody who was involved in this was driven by curiosity. And they were driven by curiosity, and they were also sort of liberated by the fact that it wasn't their main topic or anything they were really supposed to know about. So it was a really natural process and plus it's helicoprene is so weird. People sort of become fans of this animal just because it's so strange. People are smitten by it, and so it kind of is it's almost a self-selecting cult of aficionados.
And I love it.
Yeah, and people just people were drawn together, a small group of people, and they were just so intrigued by it. And all of a sudden, they started thinking, "Hey, maybe we can figure some of this stuff out." And again, all the random sort of the random connections of the story and the random chances of discovery, both discovery of the fossil and discovery of, "Oh, hey, we have this specimen that, oh my gosh, this person in 1966 said it might have fossilized jaw material, but in 1966 there weren't such things as CAT scans to look into rocks," and so. It was just this process of discovery and chance and connection and serendipity that is, to me, what makes this such a great story.
I love it. I mean, it reads beautifully, and it reads like a really, really, really great story with science in it. You know, this is not a textbook. This is not something where you've got to sit with your dictionary and look up every other word. I mean, the great, great story. And I mean, I'm a big sucker for nonfiction. That's the only thing I read. And so this book was just like, when I first picked it up, I was like, wait a second, you know, what is this? And I was like, oh my God, it's true. It's nonfiction. Yay. And it's just, I mean, I've just been glued to it. It's really, anybody out there that's a fan of sharks, or, you know, you need to read this book because it's truly, truly fascinating. And, I mean, also about, like, you know, the human thought pattern and science and how science has come in. Like, this book has got a lot of stuff going on in it, and I've really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. I felt like Helicoprene, the animal, gave me a way to sort of track the changing nature of scientific inquiry from, you know, really the 1700s to today, and that was, it was really fun for me, and what I love more than anything is when people, I think people look at the book and they go, I don't want to read that, I'm not going to read that, I'm not going to understand that, I'm not going to like that, and then they just sort of pick it up and they just sort of peek in there, and people seem to be really drawn in by the story, and so that's my favorite part is I think the book, like the shark, kind of takes people by surprise. It's a story with this just crazy beast at the center of it.
And it really, I mean, it looks like something. And you know what cracks me up, too, is like when I finally figured out, like, when I finally, finally, finally looked at it, and I was like, oh, my God, you know, it looks like something that should be, like, drawn on the side of an ancient map where they have, like, the kind of sea monsters poked out, you know, and it's like, of course, there's the Helicoprene because he should be there, you know.
Right, and which would be perfect because a lot of times they have those big giant squids and things, and that's what Helicoprene ate was the cephalopods, the squids and the octopi and the ammonites and the nautiloids and all those things. And so that would be perfect. I think I might have to draw one myself.
I mean, but then it also makes me wonder if, like, all these sea monsters on the maps, it really existed and people actually saw this stuff out at sea.
That would be cool.
You know, because, I mean, I was lucky enough to go through the Galapagos years ago, and we were on a very, very small boat, and the captain got really excited at, like, I don't know, 6 o'clock in the morning and started screaming on the megaphone. It was like, everybody get up and go, you know, whatever side of the deck it was. I'm not a boat person at all. But it was like, you know, get on deck and look over here. And we look at, and it's a sunfish, and it's this thing is like, easily between 6 and 8 feet tall. And if you've never seen a sunfish, it looks like if a little kid drew a picture of a fish and then a giant fish came up and bit it behind the gills. So it's just this weird head and then these little fins on the top and the bottom. And this thing was like murky, like brown and like freaky looking and ugly. And it is literally jumping out of the sea like a dolphin next to us chasing the boat, okay?
Oh,
I mean, it was like, what in the hell is that? I mean, it really was like, oh, my God.
Wow.
And truly terrifying. At first, it was like, are you kidding? Like, am I seeing this right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's so much incredible incredibly amazing and freaky things in the ocean that it's like, of course there would be a shark that has a, you know, a bottom jaw that looks like a table saw. Why wouldn't there be, you know?
Right.
It's
and
amazing.
The interesting thing is, before the Permian extinction, the diversity of chondrichthyans, which are the cartilaginous fish, the sharks and the rays and the skates and the ratfish, the diversity was far greater than it is today. And so, you know, you take your sunfish and whatever else you might have seen while you're snorkeling in the Galapagos, and you like, put a Tim Burton weirdness on it all and multiply it by, you know, X-fold, and that's what you have life in the Paleozoic seas, those ancient seas. Weird, weird, weird animals. Huge, huge diversity. You know, we tend to think of ancient times as sort of, I don't know, sparse, because we don't know that much about it, and we don't know the
mm-hmm.
species, but it was, you know, the seas were teeming with this just weird animals.
I mean, it's like, you know, I was lucky enough to go diving in the Philippines, too, and it was funny. The reef that I was on was actually one of the reefs that the illustrators and animators for Finding Nemo used. And I've seen the movie enough times that, like, I came around a turn on this reef, and I was like, oh, my God, this looks like Nemo's reef. And I was like, there's no way. You know, I was like, this is ridiculous. And all of a sudden, like, all these things are swimming by, and I've snorkeled a lot. And, I mean, it was like, you know, like a drinking straw that would, like, twist and untwist and twist and untwist. And it's like, no, that's a fish, you know. And then, like, some crazy eel with a huge mohawk just kind of whipping
wow.
by. And it's like, what in the hell am I looking at? You know, it felt like there was, like, some little kid in the corner drawing and then somehow putting these things to life because they didn't make any sense, because it's just so, it was so out of my realm of, you know, what I've seen underwater.
Yeah. What a
planet,
huh?
And there's so much out there that we have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so cool. It's so exciting. And it's inspiring, and it just makes you fall in love with nature all over again.
And it's made me, I mean, and your book, too, has given me this whole new insight on, you know, evolution and time and people and nature and, I mean, so many different things. And I really, I'm so honored to be speaking to you right now, and I'm so grateful that you wrote this, because I'm loving the fact that I was able to call you and have a conversation regarding this for the show, because I just
Thank
find
you.
It incredibly fascinating.
Oh, this is—it's so fun, and I love talking about it, because it's—and I was wondering how we were going to do today, because it's such a visual story, and
mm-hmm.
so usually when I talk about it, I'm able to point to pictures of things, and you know how the world worked and how it grew, and I have a little kind of flipbook animation, and so it is a really visual story, and just I could talk about it all day. I could write a book about it.
I've heard that about you. So, unfortunately, Susan, we're running out of time, which totally stinks, because I would love to talk to you more about this topic. Where can people find you? Where can people find your book? Where can people find pictures of the Helicoprion? Like, where can we send our listeners that are curious?
My website is SusanEwing.com, SusanEwing.com, and the name of the book is Resurrecting the Shark. And you can search for it on IndieBound or Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And it's interesting because this science work on Helicoprion was just done in 2013. So if you do a Google Images search, you will find some accurate representations, but you will also find a bunch of ones that are wrong. And that's
oh,
kind of
great.
Interesting, too, especially if you know the inside scoop. So,
mm-hmm.
And then the book has about 24 pages of color images in it, so there's a lot of images in the book. And I'll try to post more on my website, but anyway, if you do a Google Images search, you'll see it. And then all the major websites, you know, that list books, it's on there, too.
Perfect. So thank you again so much. Guys, go out and get this book. It's really, really cool. If you need some summer reading, it's awesome. You can read about sharks, and you don't have to get all freaked out if you're on the beach like Jaws, because these guys died 10 million years ago, so you're safe with these guys.
They died 260 million years. They predated dinosaurs, older than dinosaurs.
Oh, my God.
Way older than dinosaurs.
And it's funny, because in my brain, I'm like, ocean, this fish, you know, land, Brontosaurus Rex. It's like, well, no. It's like, okay.
Right. It takes a lot. It takes a lot to sort it out.
Amazing. Amazing. So, Susan, thank you again. Everybody, get her book. It's really, really cool, Resurrecting the Shark. It's my favorite thing I've read this year.
Oh, thank you.
And for everyone listening, thank you so much for listening. I will be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, you can follow me on Instagram at Animal Instinct Radio, Facebook at Animal Instinct 073 if you're doing a search for it, and on Twitter as The Food Healer. So have a great week, stay cool, and we'll see you next week, and take care.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.